You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 20th, 2008. Welcome, this is Bob Sprankle with Bit by Bit, and once again, we're heading back to the Building Learning Communities Conference, the BLC 2008 conference down in Newton, Mass. with the Ellen November Group. And today, we're going back to Friday, July 18th, to Clarence Fisher and Darren Kerpotwa's conference. What a team up having both of these gentlemen do a conference. Their talk is called Everything New is Old Again. You're going to really enjoy it. And one thing that I wanted to point out that I really appreciated by the talk is these guys really understand the brain. Every time they introduce something new, the timing is just perfect where they're giving the brain of their audience members a break, a new thing to attach to, plenty of visuals, plenty of things to hear and see, and just a stellar presentation. I learned so much about their topic, but also about how to better present from Darren and Clarence. This is just an incredible presentation. I know you're going to enjoy it. Going back to Friday, July 18th with Clarence Fisher and Darren Kerpotwa, Everything New is Old Again.
That's where they put the screen. not an ideal arrangement.
Put my iPod here.
So if you all want to come up a little bit, be a little more intimate, a little more interesting for you, the choice, of course, is yours. If it was my class, I'd be more insistent, but it's up to you.
Oh, look. They're out of babes.
Now, we're just encouraging people to come sit up front because that's where they put the screen. So, on the other hand, if you want to stay where you are, you may want to move to that side of the room so you can see. If you can see from where you are, it's all good. So we're just going to, it's 8:33, we're going to get started. My name is Darren Kerpotwa, Department Head of Mathematics at Daniel McIntyre Collegiate Institute. That's why we call it DMCI. That's a grade 9 through 12 high school in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And this is my friend and colleague.
I'm Clarence Fisher. I teach grade 7-8 in a town in Manitoba, but I'm about 500 miles north of Darren, a little town of about 1,000 people. Probably my whole school could fit in one of Darren's hallways. My whole school is about 145 kids, and that's K through 12. That our high school is about 43 kids last year, I think we were. But I teach junior high. I call it Hormone Alley, the place where I teach. Yeah.
Just for a sense of scale, we have about 1,200 kids from grades 9 through 12 in our school. So it's just, we work in different environments. What we wanted to do this morning was this session is kind of looking at some of the changes that are happening in our culture and our society and the impact that is suggesting for education and possible directions to pursue with pedagogy. So we're kind of going to bounce this back and forth between Clarence and I as we go. What we've got up on the screen right now is there's a URL to a wiki that I've put together for all the presentations that I'm speaking at during the conference. And there's a space on the wiki for the session Clarence and I are doing together. So it's D Kerpotwa, that's me, DKUROPATWA BLC08. I probably should have thought of something more clever. .pbwiki.com. And when you get in there, the name of this session is Everything New is Old Again. You'll see it on the right-hand side. So you have the slides there if you want to kind of skip ahead. You don't want to limit your learning. But there's a link to a chat room. And I strongly encourage you to follow the link through to the chat room and engage each other in a back-channel conversation throughout the presentation. Feel free that if you don't want to raise your hand or something, feel free to push back and push back hard in that chat. We're going to capture it afterwards. We're going to dump it on a wiki page. And if we can, we're going to come in afterwards and try to answer maybe some of the pushback that, you guys have for us. We've also built in question time throughout the session, so we really kind of want this to be more of a conversation or a dialogue than kind of you sit there, sit and get, is how my friend Dean Shireski describes it. So we're hoping that's where we go with this. So everything new is old again, living and teaching in accelerating times. We've got some video content to start us off. And the first idea, we're going to go through about four or five big ideas, is this notion of command and control. To give you a sense of what we're talking about, watch this.
We have sound.
Do we have sound? Okay, don't watch this.
Again, this is the USS Montana requesting that you immediately divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Over.
Divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid collision.
This is Captain Hancock. You will divert your course. Over.
Negative, Captain. I'm not moving anything. Change your course. Over.
Sir. This is the USS Montana, the second largest vessel in the North Atlantic Fleet. You will change course 15 degrees north, or I will be forced to take measures to ensure the safety of this ship. Over.
This is the Lighthouse Base. It's your call.
So beyond actually waking us up this morning, what Darren and I are going to try to do this morning, like you mentioned, is we've got about four things that we've come up with that are kind of trends in society. And the fact is often that education is often, we're in a responsive business. Okay, so the fact is that society does something, there's some kind of societal change, and pedagogy needs to follow that. Pedagogy needs to go along with that. Darren and I are both in vast and heavy agreement over the fact that it's never really about the tools that you're using. What it's about is figure out what you want to happen in your classroom and then find a tool that matches that. So what we're going to try to do this morning is try to look at some of these trends and then look at the pedagogy behind them. The first one we want to look at is the idea of command and control. Like the USS Montana, we think we're in control. And the big fact of the matter is in society is there seems to be almost a balancing act going on often between which side gets to be in command and which side gets to be in control. So you've got companies, for example, that are trying to lock all their content down. They're putting all strict DRM, digital rights management stuff on it, where you can't open anything up. You can only use certain players. You can only get certain content if you, can get legal access to it. And on the other side of that, you've got a lot of companies, a lot of universities, teachers, just general people that are opening everything up. And it's about being transparent, and it's about being open, it's about sharing. So you've often got this huge dichotomy that's going back and forth in society, and we really don't know where that's headed. Okay? But one part of that is the idea of hyperconnectivity. Okay? Earlier this spring, Nortel released a beautiful white paper that I encourage all of you to read about the idea of hyperconnectivity. And what they say is about 16% currently of people in society are what they call hyper-connected. So this is probably some of you geeks in here like us. These are the people who, you carry your laptop wherever you go. And actually, Nortel said that in the study, the people who are hyper-connected said they would leave their house with their laptop before they left their house with their wallet. Okay? So hyper-connectivity is the idea that we're always online. You've got your iPhone, you've got your laptop, you use Skype, you use IM, you live on your email account, all these kinds of ideas. Because we want to be in command and control of our digital presence and all of the things that looks like. Okay? So this is a very important first concept. And there's a good quote up there from Clay Shirky. How much of ourselves are we sharing? How much of ourselves are we willing to open up? we often think that if we close these things down and lock these things down, we will be in more control of them. But actually, you're probably less in control of them. Because if you're not out there looking after your name online, who is? And that gets to be a big issue, and that's something that we definitely need to work with kids on. This is an interesting couple of slides. This comes from Wesley Fryer, if you know Wesley Fryer's blog, Speed of Creativity. He last year went to a conference in Shanghai and looked at the difference about what kids had access to. China, as you know, has, they call it the Great Firewall of China, where the internet's pretty heavily filtered. And Wesley works in Oklahoma, and so what he did is he went through all the sites he could get to in Oklahoma and all the sites he could get to in Shanghai, and what he found overall is there was far more information available in China than kids had access to within their school in Oklahoma. So we often think of this idea of, you know, communist countries locking down information. Well, what does that do to our kids? Right, and what do our kids have access to? So this idea of hyperconnectivity and command and control goes along with this. Okay? So real quick, I just wanted to give this as an example. This is an example of a project that I did with my class, ITL, International Teen Life. We hooked up with three other schools, a school in Colombia, a school in Virginia, and a school in Kuala Lumpur. And we basically put all these videos together where all the kids in different places were responsible for different things. Some of them shot video, some of them did audio, some of them took photographs, and then we shipped all that to either my school in Manitoba or a school in Virginia and put all that together into some kind of video. Okay? So that's just an idea of what that might look like when you open up that place a little bit.
I encourage you to check out some of the work his kids did, because like some of the issues that they were exploring, they went into really great depth and mixed poetry and prose and video. It was really astounding, the work they did. This notion of command and control, you know, typically we like students in our classes to read the textbook, right? And in my class, I tell them, you know, that moving away from the notion of command and control is saying, I don't want them to read the textbook, that it's not going to be given to you from on high what you're responsible to learn. I tell them that they have to write the textbook. And the way they write the textbook is kind of in this hyper-connected mode, right? The suite of tools that they use to do that. So yeah, any of you that had been in any of my previous sessions, I've gone into that in a little more depth about what's involved. We call it scribe posts, etc. But it's the notion of kind of finding ways to empower students, letting, you know, shared control, like moving from a hierarchy of control to a flat level control. We see this in social bookmarking sites like Delicious. I don't know if any, how many people familiar with social bookmarking, Delicious, stuff like that? Yeah, how are your bookmarks organized? It's kind of like dumping, you put them all in there, but it's, Delicious is called a flat hierarchy, because everything's kind of equally valuable, and you tag it in ways that are personally meaningful, and then it's automatically organized so that when you click on one of your tags, you see all your related tags. So that's, we already see that we're, the way we're managing information is shifting from this kind of top-down hierarchical style. And so what are the implications of that for teaching? So some of the implications are outsourcing some of your project to Kuala Lumpur. You know, don't get your kids to write the textbook, to read the textbook, have them write it. So we thought we'd take a pause there if you have any questions or want to pursue any of those ideas. Yes?
I know you said you talked about it in the past session, so I guess it's, there's more information.
Yeah, well, what I do is I have a student each day, very quick, one student every day summarizes what happened in class that day. They publish it on the class blog, and then they end their scribe post by choosing another student in class who's going to pick up the thread the following day. And they're entirely in control. I don't get involved. I just require that it's done. But, and what happens is they kind of try, start trying to outdo each other, and it becomes quite a, quite an interesting thing that they do.
I think it's part of an overall architecture of understanding that exists in our profession, both within the members of that profession who directly work in it, teachers and administrators, and others who are sort of tangential to it, people who are developing textbooks, creating software, and both groups, both those who are not around the outside of the circle, who are thinking they know what we need And they may even be really interested in asking us what they need. Make assumptions that create products and services that really don't necessarily connect to what kids need.
Yeah.
And the same thing for teachers, who even people in this room, and myself, we develop routines and understandings on architecture, if you will, that prevents us from really opening up on all the time to new ideas, new ways of thinking about things, new ways of putting things together.
Well, I think this concept, actually, and Darren and I have talked about this. We spent too much time together. We've talked about this quite a bit, but this idea of command and control and kids being in control of a lot of content is actually very challenging to a lot of people who make a lot of money in education. Mm-hmm. Right? When you're looking at companies that make millions of dollars in textbooks and millions of dollars producing software and producing content and all this kind of stuff, I think this is a very challenging concept. And I know one thing, like with my class, we blog, we podcast, we've got all the kind of, you know, tools that you could want, but for my classroom, for my entire year, for my technology budget, I spent $25. You know, and that's I pay for a pro Flickr account, and that's it. You know, you can blog for free, you can get wiki accounts for free, you can get all this stuff for free. And so this idea of command and control can be quite challenging to people who make a lot of money.
I wonder how the textbook companies feel about what my students are doing. Because they're getting a lot more value out of writing the textbook than they would ever get out of reading it. And so with the suite of resources that are available on the internet and the way we can share that now and dig into that, I don't really want to use a textbook. I'm kind of really comfortable with the kids being the authors. So I've never had a conversation with anyone from any of the big companies. We don't need to name names, but... interesting.
Yeah. Do you find this works as effectively for math as the other subject areas in terms of writing the textbook?
Got the I'm in math?
Yeah.
I got the idea from an English teacher.
No, you got the idea
from an English teacher. It's working very effectively in a math class.
It is.
It's my view that sort of pedagogy is broadly applicable across disciplines and across grade levels. I think you have to modify it somewhat. There was a talk I gave actually at the school that Clarence works with in Los Angeles, Barbara Bareda's school. I spoke to them last summer, and we were looking at ways that they could implement the notion of scribe posts for kindergarten to grade 2, then grades 3 to 6, or 4 to 6, and then 7 and beyond. So I think it's broad. There are ways to make it work.
We do the same kind of thing actually in grades 7 and 8, only I do it with history, where my kids basically write their own history textbook, and we keep it year to year. So, sorry.
I just want to make the point, because you're both modeling effective teaching and effective instruction for students who are struggling readers and writers. And once we have it on the internet, once we have it digital, now it is accessible to all kids. They can attach to it. Textbooks are inflexible. You can sit there for disabled, they can't access.
Kids can do some really cool stuff when you let them write the textbook.
And it also, of course, leads to a whole host of other things, such as evaluating online information and, all the things that go with that, right? Liz?
I sometimes freelance. I write the teacher wrap around the outside of those textbooks that nobody actually needs. but I have gotten, no work at all. I have no freelance textbook work at all this summer. And it's definitely,
That's interesting.
Blame it on Darren.
I made the mess of not cleaning it up. So we're going to accelerate into second gear now. We're going to look at something that we call the fourth screen. You'll see in a moment about the... Well, watch this, and we'll talk some more about the fourth screen.
In the beginning was a screen. Millions of us came together in a public place to understand the present, to see visions of the future, sharing emotions, sharing experiences that shaped our lives.
I have a dream.
Then there was a second screen.
Where do you want it, Governor?
It connected us to our world, and even to other worlds. It gave us amazing new games to play, made us think, and got us talking. But although this is a world we could all share, the experience itself was becoming private. Then came a third screen. It changed the way we worked and played. It became part of something much bigger, the internet. And a revolution happened. We could play new games in new ways, find new music in new places, new communities, new kinds of communities emerged. But the experience had become individual, even solitary. The sense of community felt real, but it was virtual. And then everything changed. And it changed forever. Everything came to us in a device that could fit into our pocket. We went back out into the world. We listened to what we loved, when we liked. We played when we wanted, where we chose. We shared what inspired us with everyone we cared about. We carried our sense of purpose with us. We discovered new people and places and experiences. And our sense of purpose kept growing. It was the end of something. It was the beginning of everything. Welcome to the fourth screen.
Fourth screen you probably have in your pocket. And I'll let Clarence talk about this, and then we'll do something with your fourth screen, so get them ready.
The story that comes out of this, I mean, this is the idea of on-demand information, right? Wherever you go, wherever you might be. And actually, I have two stories for this that come out of just last night, out of the boat cruise. Okay, and the first one was, cruising up and down the shore last night, there's a big stone fort on one side of the harbor. And I asked about five or six people last night, what is that? And of course, everybody had something to tell me. Ah, you Canadians, you know, yeah, it's fort, whatever. But the funny thing was that everybody I asked had a different name for it. So I figured, okay, so nobody knows what this fort is. And then I went to some very smart people last night and said, you know, what is the name of this fort? Does anybody know? And out came the iPhones. And on to Google we went and just Googled up forts in Boston Harbor and ended up at a Wikipedia page. And now, let's see if I can even remember the name. It was Fort Warren, right, was the name of it, I think. Right. And learned all last night that Warren was the guy who actually sent Paul Revere out on his ride and was killed at the Battle of Bunker Hill. And I knew something from the boat in the middle of the harbor. Okay. The other story last night is I was talking to Brian Mull, who works for November Learning, and the story he had to tell me was, as we were standing on the side, he asked me, he said, have you ever seen a website called Cha-Cha? And I don't know, have any of you seen Cha-Cha? I had never seen this, and the top of my head almost blew off. So Cha-Cha.com, he pulled out his iPhone, too.
Do you have a pen I could borrow?
Okay. So he pulled out his phone, went to Cha-Cha.com, and what Cha-Cha is you can just send them a question. And it's really like an SMS message. And so I was telling him about this experience I had just had with this fort. And he said, oh, no problem. So he pulled out his iPhone, went to Cha-Cha.com, sent them a message, and said, what is the name of the fort in Boston Harbor? Put it away, put it in his pocket. And we stood there talking, and after about 2 minutes, his phone rang, picked it up. And what Cha-Cha is there's a real person at the other end of that who's actually looking for your questions. And the person at the other end, so it was kind of like an eBay rating that you got the person's profile back, and we also got the name of the fort, which matched. See, we were triangulating our data. It was validating online information. But Brian then went on to tell me is you can just sign up to be a question answerer with Cha-Cha. I think he said you make 20 cents for every question you answer. And he said, you know, you can be sitting at home at night doing nothing and just you basically fill out a form and sign up. And if you're sitting around doing nothing, people, you know, you'll get these messages from Cha-Cha and, you know, you'll browse and go find the answers and send them back and make 20 cents. You know. So then, of course, I had this idea about, you know, turning your classroom into a slave labor farm where you could put these kids to work every day and let's make some money here, you know. Mind you, at 20 cents a question, I don't think we're getting rich too fast. But it's that idea of on-demand information, okay? And, I mean, again, I'm not making any money from Apple, but it amazes me, those devices. I mean, it's a Mac in your pocket. It's your information in your pocket. And how does that change things? And how does that change what is content, what content really is, and what content can be when we have access to information in the middle of Boston Harbor, you know, when you need it? And the other question that really makes me wonder is, what did we do before we had these things? You know, like when we were curious about something, you know, we kind of sat and said, geez, I wonder what the name of that fort is. And then you forgot it. And, you know, maybe a week later you'd remember, geez, I need to find that out. You know, and probably 9 times out of 10 you wouldn't remember. Yeah. But it really is that idea of on-demand information, you know, is a fascinating idea that really can change our classrooms.
So if you've got your fourth screen out, what I'd like you to do, if you're in my session yesterday, this was, it was 2 days ago now, we did this really neat thing, and we didn't actually get a chance to see the results. So today we'll see some of the results, and we're going to try to do this live. What I'd like you to do is use your camera phone to take a picture of anything in the room, and I'd like you to start taking pictures and keep taking pictures, and send them to this email address. I'll read it for you. It's set59local@photos.com.
Photos.flickr.com.
So start taking pictures and sending them out to this email address. If you have the functionality built into your laptops, you can use the camera on your laptop to even just take a picture yourself and send it right out, email it directly to this email address. That email address is my Flickr account. So let me explain to you what's going on as you take these pictures and send them off. That's my private email account. I don't normally share this publicly. And immediately after this session, that will no longer work because I'm going to change it. Okay? And what happens is with my cell phone, I can take a picture wherever I am in the world and send it to that email address, and it's automatically in my Flickr account. So what? Well, what I've done something else. I've set up my Flickr account to automatically tag any picture that's sent to that email address. It's automatically going to get the tag new as old 08. That's the tag that we're using for this session. So what? Well, nice thing about tags is RSS. And we've created a slideshow. We're going to show you in a moment. We created a slideshow that's going to pull on all the pictures that have that tag on them. So the stuff you're adding is automatically getting tagged. And elsewhere on the internet, using a different tool, created a slideshow that's sucking on the tag from my Flickr account, aggregating all of those photos and turning them into a slideshow. And so now, I hope I gave some of you enough time to get some of the pictures in. We're going to see if we can see that live. So the pictures that you've been sending as I've been talking have been aggregated. And this is kind of just the one that I seeded it with. And there's only the one picture. Well, the nice thing about having done this before is that the other day I was talking about, we were talking about the pedagogy, and in my session I was talking about these were pictures that were taken in session just the way you guys did, and they were emailed to my account, and then they've been aggregated here in this slideshow. And I get kids to use their cell phones to walk around the world and find math in very unusual places, tag it, label it, they put it online, we aggregate it through RSS on the class blog. And it's as easy as that. It's as easy as a kid walking around with their cell phone.
Yeah,
we have more than one now. We have three. Okay, so it looks like we might have got some more pictures into the other account.
Yeah.
So let's take a look.
A picture of yourself.
Set59local@photos.flickr.com. So I don't know if there's anybody in the Ustream, actually, who wants to send pictures. Very cool. That would be great. Send your photos, too. So it's just loading up now.
By the way, Darren,
yeah.
My Ustream crashed.
It crashed?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we have a second one running as well.
Okay, good.
So there we have just the two images.
I have three.
You have three. What I'll do is we'll let this run. Okay, we can come back and look at this later. So I just encourage you to keep taking those pictures throughout the session, and we'll see what happens. And let's go back to this. So so what we're talking about here is the pedagogy behind this. Should cell phones be banned from the classroom? I had a conversation with Corey. You and I were talking last night, and we were talking about how the cell phone, in the next year, there's this prediction that 2008 will mark the long-awaited era of the mobile content era. That you have a cell phone now, it can take a picture, it can record audio, it can take video. I'm very happy you're doing that.
Yeah.
And it does all these things. Now, interesting thing about creativity is that sometimes people think that to be creative, you need to be able to not have boundaries. Now, I don't feel that's true. Being creative means to play with boundaries. And so to be creative means there has to be some kind of boundary. Ewan was talking about this in one of his talks yesterday when he showed a video about the Grand Central freeze and how one person, they were supposed to stand still, but one person had kind of almost fallen over. And that's how they chose to freeze. And that was creative. It added to the experience. So the notion of playing with boundaries. So you got that cell phone. But you have your kids go out into the world and let them take a series of one-minute videos. Make it pithy. Make it meaningful. And then take three, four, five of them, string them together into one single short, 5 minutes or less, because more than that we tend not to have patience for, right? And make a meaningful video that way. We're actually going to talk about some other clever ways that people have come up with to make video. Make a podcast that way. Go on a field trip. Snag the pictures. Send them to the class Flickr account. Record the audio. Upload it to Gcast, which is a free service online where you can upload podcasts. And you can automatically have this published to your class blog. Bob Sprankle right now is doing this fascinating experiment. It was one of the things that I was most excited about coming to the conference was to sit and bend his ear for a couple minutes. Because he's exploring all the possibilities that can be done with what's called mo-blogging, mobile blogging. So he's got a blog, right? What's the URL, Bob?
Just go to Bob's, let's see.
BobSprankle.com?
Well, it might be a little harder than that.
Okay.
Let me come up with the real one.
Okay, he's going to find it and we'll share it. But I think from BobSprankle.com, which is his homepage, I think you have a link off to the experiment.
Off the bit by bit. That's
off of bit by bit.
A little convoluted.
So he's getting every single mobile service from his cell phone. He's uploading audio, pictures. He hasn't done video yet, but I'm sure that's going to be done before the year is done. It's interesting. Should cell phones be banned by schools? Dean Shiresky is an educational technologist in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. One of the schools that he teaches, they actually embrace the cell phone. And the kids are using it in their classroom in many of the ways that we've been describing. This is not a prediction, really, anymore. This is happening. Any discussion around that? Yeah.
Given concerns around equity and digital divide, I know different countries have different plans for cell phones, but when you get into the data streaming stuff, it can be expensive for kids that are not
connected. You're right. It can be. Do you have an answer to that?
Yeah. I
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that if we, instead of having laptops, schools had just a couple carts with cell phones, you have reliable internet access then, which we do not. I work in New York City, Department of Ed, Office of Instructional Technology. We do not have reliable internet access at all. Cell phones would give us that access and be much, much cheaper than laptops and the non-working internet access.
I'm just so interested to hear you say that because I live, like I said, in a small community, literally in the middle of nowhere, and I'm so interested to hear somebody from New York say you don't have reliable internet service. My problem is almost the opposite. Where I live, we don't even have cell service. Okay, and so yeah, I mean that is the middle of nowhere these days. So what we've gone the other way, and it's pretty well the same price as lots of these little cell phones, is I have a bunch of those little Asus EPCs in my classroom, and yeah, like that. Mine are black, but they have a camera on them, Same thing. And actually, I stole one of my ideas from Darren, and what I did this year is I had the kids take those out, and we took them around the playground and every place and took pictures of them, and the kids used it to take pictures of geometric concepts. So pictures went out in the playground, took pictures of angles and lines and all sorts of stuff, and they just used those little EPCs to go around and take pictures, click, and then we uploaded them to our Flickr account and dealt with them that way. So even though, like, there's a way around all this stuff if you really put your minds to it, right?
How much is it?
You can get them for $300.
Yeah.
They have a new one that now has 16 gig and a 9-inch screen that's
$399.
Yeah.
They're really cheap.
And you know
what?
They are absolutely bomb-proof. Like, they do not have a hard drive. Like, it's just like a flash drive inside them. And, I mean, teaching grade 7 and 8, right? I mean, there's been a number of them that have hit the floor in my classroom, and they run Linux. They're rock solid.
It's funny, because I'm watching you listen to this, and often I say to my audiences, like, I have no idea what's going on behind your eyes, but I can kind of see, like, you're, the world is opening. Like, there's so much stuff I can do.
You have some sunglasses?
it's interesting, because it's... Unless we know what is possible, we know what's out there, we can't dream, right? You can only dream about what you know. So, like, you kind of hear about this, and what was it, ChaCha.com?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all these things are now possible, so then you can start wondering, okay, well, how am I going to make that fit into the way I teach? Like, our culture is accelerating faster and faster, and the reason our session is called Everything New is Old Again, because as soon as you learn something new, it's old.
Yeah.
Right? Like, things are changing really fast. So what are the implications for that in our classroom? Well, some people think it's scary. We have a different perspective. It's exciting. It's new possibilities. We can do stuff we've never done, and we got to be willing to change the paradigms that we've grown up with in our classrooms.
Anybody else have any thoughts about on-demand information? Or?
We should move. We're going to run out of time.
Well, yeah.
We got some more stuff.
We're always going to run out of time.
This one's cool. We got a lot to talk about. This is called Boundaries Blur, Accelerating into Third Gear. And this one, we're going to start... The media will come after this, because it's an interesting media bit. I'll let Clarence talk about it.
I mean, this is Second Life. Right. Second Life is the poster child for this kind of stuff. So how do we blur those boundaries between real life and our lives online? Right. I mean, the internet used to be a place that you would go to. Right. I remember when I first got a computer, it was in like the spare bedroom of my house before I had kids. Right. And you trot in there, you know, once in the evening or once every couple of days even, and look, I've got two emails. Now my wife and I have laptop arguments, you know, about who can get online faster to find the stuff that you need. You know, you got a wireless network running in your house, you know. Yeah, and she's got a MacBook Air, so she's faster than I am. I'm losing these days bad. Yeah, so the idea of what's online and what's offline and how that really comes together is really changing. And this really goes with the last one. This really goes with the idea of on-demand information, okay? The two things that we're going to look at... Maybe pull them both up there, Darren. The two things that we're going to look at are A Swarm of Angels and the Get Out Clause. Maybe let's start with Get Out Clause.
Okay.
Yeah. The Get Out Clause, this is really cool. Probably some of you have seen this. There's a band in London that's called the Get Out Clause that are just starting up. And, I mean, poor, starving musicians. And what they did is... living in the UK, of course, you're always under video surveillance. Actually, this article from Wired, I think it says someplace in there that the average British citizen in London has their picture taken every 6 seconds.
Wow.
If you're in London. And so what these guys did is, starting up band, they went and stood in front of all the surveillance cameras that they could find. And set up all their equipment and played this one song. And then under British law, you have the right to access any footage that, if you can say, you know, I was here at this time within the last 30 days, they have to give you kind of like an access to information kind of thing, right? So these guys went and stood before these video cameras over a couple of weeks, played their song, then filed an access for information report, got all their footage, put all that together into a video. You know, it's the music is terrible, I got to tell you, but what a concept. You know, it's such an excellent concept. And again, it's blurring that idea of living your life offline or living your life online, right? How does that look?
No, the streaming's not coming through really well. But you'll see in the video that they have all of the images are time-stamped. Security cameras all over the place.
That probably made editing really easy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the government has to film your video for you.
Yeah.
And they have to give it to you. And all you do is edit.
Put it together for free. Okay. Let's flip over to the other one, Darren. The other one is the same kind of idea, but it's called a swarm of angels. And what a swarm of angels is a group trying to put together a film, like a feature-length film, using basically content that people have sent them from all over. So you could have signed up. I think it's closed now.
But they're at stage three.
Yeah, you could have signed up with a swarm of angels, submit some video, and then they took video from all over the place. You know, hundreds of thousands of people submitted all their stuff, and they took all the stuff and put it together.
Just a really short. It's longer. You can get into the site, and it tells you more information. But the director, right, has this idea, and in order to fund it and make it take off, she's basically, you know, the cinematographer, and everybody's kind of a volunteer, and everybody's contributing. Like, I don't know if anybody was at the Kiva session the other day, but they're kind of using a similar model to fund this film. Sorry, Bob.
Well, I just want to, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just used Cha-Cha to find out who you are. And here's the answer from a live person. He is a math teacher in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Okay, well, there you go. That's the right on.
What was that? 20 cents.
20 cents for that? I don't know what that says about Darren's worth, you know, if it's only 20 cents.
You're up next, Darren.
I'm still working for Chacha.
I gave the answer, by the way.
So we're going to show you how the boundaries continue to blur with the live story that something that happened in Calgary just in the last little while.
It is amazing. With the internet nowadays, when we come back, we have an incredible story of how some Calgary guys used the net to find a stolen car, and we'll show you the arrest.
Thank you, Steve. Well, the internet today helped a group of Calgarians catch a thief.
The story starts earlier this week when someone stole a car during a test drive. The rare vehicle went missing on Wednesday. The owner called police and then posted pictures of the car on a website for car enthusiasts called beyond.ca. Soon after, people in Calgary started emailing sightings of the car. Those emails eventually led to a home in southeast Calgary. Someone called police and then videotaped the arrest. One person was taken into custody by police. Lane Fraser is on this, and Lane, the owner, is really crediting the website for getting his car back.
He is. I'm at the lot, Ian, where the car was taken. In fact, that's the car right behind me. It's a right-side drive, high-performance vehicle. It's in good condition, not too much worse than wear, we don't think. The owner does credit the website for getting this car back. We also spoke with the founder of that website. He says the site has been absolutely inundated with hits from around the world because of this whole issue surrounding this missing car. And he says this isn't the first time that the website has helped a car owner who was a victim of a crime.
Last year, there was a hit and run accident that happened, and one of the members caught the perpetrator at the time and got pictures of it and put it on the internet. And next thing you know, we had the cops found the guys that did it, and it was a, you know, web sensational story.
I made a posting with the car, a bunch of pictures, description of the guy, and the forum members took it from there. The forum members were absolutely outstanding.
And Lane, police do have some advice for people who want to get involved in solving a crime, and it really is, don't get too involved.
That's right. I have a concern over this case, and here's why. We have a picture that shows what appears to be two website users who had spotted the stolen car trying to block it in. That was posted on the website. Was posted by a website user, and he says he took the picture of the suspect near Chinook Mall. He gestured at the suspect, trying to get a closer look and a photo. That concerns police because they say that people just don't know what they're getting into. The internet is a great tool in this instance, but you don't know what a suspect is going to do, and the best bet is not to try to block a car or to interact with a suspect at all, but to just call police immediately. And investigators do tell me that an 18-year-old will be facing theft charges in this case.
So it's a really fascinating story because the fellow driving by in the other car is one of the people from the website beyond.ca, and he keeps trying to, like, you've got a cool car, knowing full well it's a stolen car, but the guy, the thief, doesn't know that he's being tracked by this person and a whole host of others behind him. So what does that have to do for what we do in our classrooms? How many people have heard of geocaching? Interesting activity, geocaching, right? Because geocaching is one of the things that really kind of changes the boundaries of our classrooms. What's different, what's happening now with all of these tools is in a traditional classroom, you all had to be in the same space at the same time. And that was when you were going to learn, and that was it. But what's happening now is we can kind of shift time and shift space. And different tools, this is an image I made over a year ago, thinking about this stuff, and it probably needs to be updated because there's a lot more stuff that has come out since then. But, you know, like museums is where you go to learn in the same space at different times. Geocaching's like that. It's when you're playing a game in the same space but different times. Second Life and Skyping and using Google Docs is where you may be at the same time doing something but in vastly different places. Right, you could be. You and I can both be in Second Life together. You might be in the United States, Scotland, Australia, Ireland, and I'm in Winnipeg, Canada. But we're in that space together at the same time. So we can also go beyond time and beyond space. And blogs and wikis means that you can come to a place to learn, no matter what space you're in, no matter what time you like. Google Docs is interesting because it kind of. One of the most wonderful things about it is that it crosses these boundaries, right? Because you could be in different times and different spaces, but you can also be in different spaces at the same time, and you see the changes live as they're happening, right? I mean, you could be same time and place, but then why would you work on a Google Doc? But whatever. but you understand what's going on. So this opens up vistas for things that we can do in our classroom, and we can time shift learning. That the class, when you're teaching your students, class is not limited by that 1 hour that you see them. The boundaries of the classroom have dissolved. The time that you're limited for learning has dissolved, and you have much more time if you leverage the tools in a way that helps you do that. So the questions always are, what do you want your students to learn and how do you want to teach it? Then we'll look at what affordances are available with different tools. This is Jean-Claude Bradley is a professor of chemistry at Drexel University. And he's been using these tools for a while now in his classes. And this is what's interesting about him. This is a bonus assignment. Not every student has to do this. But in his class, for bonus marks, what you can do, you go into Second Life and you build a molecule of a chemical compound. And I used to know which chemical compound this was, but now I don't. That's Jean-Claude in the bottom left corner. So the student, his chemistry students, go into Second Life, and they have to put the right atom with the right linkages. It has to have the right geometry, and then they can walk through the molecule and see how all this fits together. And the nice thing about this is more and more students do this over time. He's got this archive of molecules that he can point to and use in his class, that if students are struggling with that content, then, well, let me show you what it really looks like. And it becomes much more visceral. So the boundaries are blurring. Also, his classes, he no longer lectures any of his classes. He doesn't assign textbook readings. He assigns podcasts and videos. They are podcasts and videos of previous lectures that he's given. When the students come to him in class, it's all hands-on. Let's get down and dirty. Let's work with the problems. Let's solve these, whatever it is that we're working on, solve whatever problems. And he's more of a coach than a teacher. He's a professor in university now.
What's
so,
his last name?
Bradley. Jean-Claude Bradley. Strongly recommend you follow his work. Any other discussion around these ideas? Because we got one more.
That's right there in front of the university.
Drexel University, Drexl in Pennsylvania.
What actually this makes me think of is when Darren and I actually made up this presentation, we've been working on it, well, for a couple of months for sure, but then just finishing, we were finishing stuff last week, and Darren was in Winnipeg, and I was actually out in Edmonton, Alberta, like two provinces away, and we started off finishing this off, and I went to a Starbucks at night to do some work, and then I got tired of everybody walking by, you know, looking at Darren's face on my screen. You know, they thought I was just talking to my computer. So first I moved outside to the patio. And first of all, that wasn't any better, because then I literally had this crowd of kids at one point, you know, behind me. And then the guy came out of the Starbucks and said, you know, we're closing in 10 minutes. And I said, oh, man, what are we going to do? And I said, I know. I told Darren, I picked up my laptop. I said, we're going on a field trip. And out to my office. So I picked up my laptop, walked the 50 yards or so to my truck in the parking lot, where my truck was parked, and managed to pull the wireless out there and sat in my truck for about an hour and a half after the Starbucks had closed, and we managed to get all of this finished last week. So, you know, again, it's really that idea, a time and place. I mean, it doesn't really matter.
And we were initially fleshing out our ideas in a Google Doc, in a Word doc, in Google Docs, and then when we were actually starting to put the slides together, we did it in a
Google presentation.
So that we could both edit it live. So I'm working on slide 6, he's working on slide 17,
yeah.
And we're just kind of talking through it on Skype at the same time, and then we downloaded
then we
the whole thing
this
on Monday. We downloaded the whole thing and then
from
just
a
put the
perspective. Think about what that solves for a teacher. Okay, you assign a PowerPoint project to a group of 5 students. I have the disk today.
Yeah.
So I work on it.
Yeah.
I break it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's completely asynchronous and completely on-demand learning.
Right, completely. What else it's huge with is with ideas of, I mean, well, I don't have Word at home, or I don't have PowerPoint at home. Like, it doesn't matter. You know,
you
give kids tools and say, you know, sorry, you got no excuse, do your homework.
First day of my class every year, all my students have to sign up for a Google account.
Yeah, my place.
And they got to get Google Docs, and they got to get a Blogger account, and they get all of that stuff, and it's all free.
Yeah.
So then the kids come to me and say, but I don't have PowerPoint. I say, well, yes, you do. You signed up for that account.
You bet.
Right?
Can
I ask you a question? What do you think about having kids use Gmail versus email?
I think it's wonderful. There are issues, I know, in school districts because of the chat feature that's built in to Gmail. Although, the chat, you can block just the chat. Also, Google is very, very... from what I've seen, and I haven't explored this myself, so take all of this now with a grain of salt. From what I've seen is that Google is very willing to work with educational institutions to help them implement system-wide Google suite of tools for educators to support that district, so that every educator, every student gets a Gmail account and all the entire suite of tools that comes with it. And if you need that, you have a certain level of control that comes with it as the administrator. So that's something else. Google's been very supportive that way of educators.
Let's move on to our last.
Let's move on.
We just got one.
We're accelerating. This is the last one. We're in fourth gear now, the human network.
Is video first?
There's video first. Video first.
Welcome. Welcome to a brand new day. A new way of getting things done. Welcome to a place where maps are rewritten and remote villages are included. A place where body language is business language. Where people subscribe to people, not magazines. And the team you follow now follows you. Welcome to a place where books rewrite themselves. Where you can drag and drop people wherever they want to go. and a phone doubles as a train ticket, plane ticket, or lift ticket. Welcome to a place where a wedding is captured and recaptured again and again. Where a home video is experienced everywhere at once. Where a library travels across the world. Where businesses are born, countries are transformed, and we're more powerful together than we ever could be apart. Welcome to the Human Network.
Now, I'm always must be a true geek because that always almost brings tears to my eyes. And I always, you know, it's funny because I've used this a lot in a lot of presentations I've done, and I always tell people, you know, I need to be sending video to Cisco because they need to send me my 20 cents for every time I do it. I mean, this is what it's all about, right? This really brings all these four things together. And again, because you need the stuff. I mean, you need your laptop, you need your phone, you need the accounts. But it ain't about the stuff. You know, it's about us. And it's always the most valuable part of any conference, you know, is actually if Darren and I really had done you a favor this morning, we would have got up and said, you know, introduced ourselves and then closed the door and said, okay, what do you want to talk about? Because, I mean, this is what it's about. It's about hooking kids together in a lot of ways. And shameless plug, if you can put up with me a second time, I'm doing another session this afternoon at 1:30 or whatever it is, about just about my classroom. And it's about that idea of bringing kids together. You know, how do you hook kids with kids, and how do you bring kids together with information? And I call that idea teacher as network administrator. So how do you bring this stuff all together? With all the tools we have, with Skype, you know, my kids all have Skype accounts. My kids all have RSS accounts. They all have Google accounts. What it does, it gives you that chance really to open that window, okay, into another place, another time, information in new ways. Okay, so that's really what this idea is about. It's about all your Facebook accounts. I think Ewan showed this the other day.
It's from Facebook. This is from Twitter.
Yeah, this is actually from Twitter. Facebook has the same thing, but this is called a tweet wheel. This is yours, I think, Darren, isn't
it? This is my tweet wheel. And when I first did this, what's interesting is when you have this, and I think it's tweetwheel.com, if you want to get one for yourself, see what your network looks like on Twitter. And this is not my full network. This is only the, I think it's 100. They choose 100
You get 100 or something.
You get 100 people. So there's my network's bigger than that. But what was interesting to me about this is when you put your mouse over one of these people, it shows you who this person is connected to in their network that's also in my network. So what it's showing you is where the networks overlap. What's striking to me is kind of the nodes that have very few connections. Like, for example, this node here, Warren Malansky, has got one connection out with someone else in my network, and it's with Art Gore. And those are the only two people. They have each other's connections and me, but no one else in my network is connected to them. It's interesting to me also, like when I look at Matthew Engang, he's a professor of mathematics, I think he's at Harvard or MIT, I don't remember which. We actually connected through SlideShare. He was watching some of the stuff that I was doing and started emulating the way I was using slides in my classes. And his classes, we had a wonderful conversation about copyright for a little while. We haven't spoken to each other in a while, but now that the connection exists, it's really easy to pick it up again. He has no other connections to my network, but through him, if he had a network, right, his tweet wheel, maybe over here, has got all kinds of other connections. So these networks overlap, and if you've got someone in your network that maybe belongs, you look at it, and you think it's the ones that have lots of connections, and those people are really valuable to me. Because this is my community where I talk and I get feedback and they push me, making me a better teacher. But I also really value, you know, Dave Delaney, who only has one other connection in my network. I value Matthew Lane Gang and those people that have very few links, because it's through them that it opens a window into an entirely different network. It's all about the people. It's not about the tools. And some of the implications for this is the idea of open or enclosed windows. Through the power of RSS, some of the things that I do on my blog
is I have RSS feeds that go out to other classes. Like your class did a wiki, and on my, her AP class does a wiki, Paula's AP class. Where are you again?
Georgia.
In Georgia.
Atlanta.
We're in Winnipeg. So Paula has this wiki going that her kids are creating content. I put a feed window on my class blog so my students see every time one of her students makes an update on the wiki, my kids see it reflected immediately on our class blog. We've got, there's a teacher in northwestern Manitoba who's teaching the same course I am. So, and he's blogging with his kids. So we have another feed window there, and that goes right into his class. So as his kids are writing scribe posts and generating content, my kids are seeing that updated at the same time. Back on his blog, he's got a window open to my class blog. So the links and connections, the kids can actually connect with other kids who are learning the same content at the same time and have a different perspective on it. And if they didn't understand it the first time, then they have so many different perspectives to access, so many different nodes in their networks that they can pursue to help them learn. And it's that's what it's all about. Creating nodes in the networks, and those nodes, it's kind of an unfortunate term used to describe people, right? There's a Cole Campbellese is a educational technologist at PSU, Pennsylvania State, and he says that Web 2.0 is Soylent Green, right? Soylent Green is people. Okay, it's an old movie, so
you've just ruined the ending for me. I haven't seen it yet.
I'm sorry. My bad. Bad teacher. So this is the other one. Now, interesting thing happened in my class. I was so fascinated by some of the ways my students are starting to innovate and use the various tools. I started recording these podcasts. I call it Student Voices. And we're about five of these in. I've made five of them. The last one was made kind of after the exams, at the end of the school year, when two of my students came to talk to me, and they were sharing with me this really innovative way they came up with to study and do their work. So what I've got for you is about a two-minute audio clip of the conversation of this podcast. The podcast is about 20 minutes long, and it's on my blog, Student Voices, Episode 5, and so you can pursue that. Sorry. Lucy. Hi. I just saw you. I had to say hi, I'm sorry. And in a way, that kind of underscores the point, right? It's, I wanted to meet Lucy. Lucy's in my network.
You saw me yawn, and that's the end of your kindness.
I totally empathize. You too. Anyways, I want you to listen. But this is where I kind of summarize the conversation that we've been having. So I usually try to let them talk more than me, but you'll hear most.
Your friends for the last couple of years, your own innocent anyways, you always just leave it open. And so one night it so happened you asked someone a question. This happens all the way back in February, at the beginning of the semester, about some math, maybe a question from homework, whatever. One thing leads to another, and you download, I mentioned in class you should use the SmartBoard software, so you guys download that stuff, and then you start capturing problems from old exams that are available online. Mm-hmm. Questions from the blog, I'm guessing?
And Math4DS.
Math4DS.com. So you go there and you grab all these questions, mm-hmm. and you send them to each other, both of you solve them, compare the results. Yep. When they agree, you agree, and you say, okay, we got it. When you guys disagree, you have a discussion about it, and you go back to the class blog to pull justification for why you think you're right when that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Trying to convince the other to
look. Then type it on Google.
And then you can search it on Google.
Yeah.
And so as you guys are doing this naturally, some of the classmates that are in your class see you guys on MSN and end up coming to you for help with different questions at different times. Yeah. At one point, there's as many as four of you mm-hmm. who are doing this live, interactive, and you can go for as much as 6 hours a night doing this, 3 or 4 nights a week.
Yeah.
Forget about dinner, we just have some ramen noodles.
Oh, yeah.
And you're doing this not just in math, you're doing it in physics and chemistry and any other subjects?
Yeah, biology.
Yeah. So math and the sciences, mm-hmm. right? This is what you're doing it in. And you end up, your other classmates reach out to you through MSN every now and again to get your help as mentors to help them understand what they're doing in class.
Yeah.
And this is something you guys just came up with on your own.
Yeah.
It's neat. They did it by themselves. It was their idea. So it's the whole notion of the human network, right? And they've agreed, at the end of the podcast we talk about it, that these two boys have agreed. One of them's graduated, gone on to university, but the other one will be taking calculus with me next in September. And they've both agreed to come back to model this kind of study practice for all my classes next year, and they're going to be mentors to the other students. Now, these students have been mentored because I bring in people from all over the world to mentor my classes through their blogs, and so they've been mentored for a few years, and they've kind of got a feel for what that tastes like. Some other students of mine that have recently just graduated started mentoring Clarence's students. As Clarence's students, we're working with Barbara's students in Los Angeles.
And we're working with a grade 5 class in Georgia. So it was all coming down the pipe, like all of this mentoring started at the far end and ended up, I guess the ultimate recipient was a grade 5 class in Georgia of all this where it went through.
Well, that's interesting, though, because it goes up and it goes not only down, it comes back up. Because Alec Kouros, who is a professor of education at the University of Regina, has two classes of student teachers that mentor one of my class. The student teachers doing this for the first time say, well, what does that look like? Like, how do we leave an appropriate mentoring comment? So my students, who have been mentored for several years and are now mentoring Clarence's students and Barbara's students, talk to the student teachers to teach them how to be appropriate mentors online. So this is like network spaghetti. Okay? But the upshot of all of this is it's not about the tools, it's about the people.
Now, we are over time, but it doesn't look like anybody's rushing to get in. If you'd like to stay for a few more minutes, does anybody have any questions, any thoughts about this idea of networks?
Does anyone ever do anything inappropriate? Actually,
I talked about this in my other... I'm trying to find a place where I can stand and see it, sorry. In my other session, that I've been blogging with my kids for 4 years, and out of the 4 school years that we've been involved, we have had two inappropriate comments left on blogs. And our blogs are wide open to the world. I subscribe to them by RSS and read everything, obviously, that they read, but quite honestly, and a lot of recent research actually backs me up, is all of the scare around this stuff really does not exist, or exists in very, very isolated cases.
We should talk some more. Happy to answer those questions. It's just been pointed out to me the reason no one's trying to get in is because the keynote presentation's about to take place. So, fifth degree, we have no slides for it. It's experts. All of this stuff is about the disappearance of the experts. That's why there's no more slides. You're all experts in different ways, so the fact that we're talking today doesn't make us the experts. I can't wait to see what you guys did in the chat and the photos you took. That archive will stay there for you to continue this conversation for as long as you like, and I encourage you to do so. Thanks for coming out today.
Thank you.